You're such a quiet audience. I've never had one like this before. I thought I'd put you all into trance straight away. Okay, what I'm going to do today is talk about how to get more love and joy into your life, and then we'll do a simple exercise at the end to actually do that. Everybody okay with that?
Yeah.
Good.
Okay, so I'll explain who I am. I'm Stephen Blake. I am now, due to rebranding, the Thought Tamer. I used to be the Thought Coach, but I don't like the idea of coach. Sounds like somebody who leans over you and says, four more press-ups, now. And that's not what I do. I'll explain what I do a bit later in more detail. But this is... Are you all right there in the sunlight?
Yeah.
If it does get any dry, just move across to a seat. Like everybody can be comfortable, that happens. Okay, I'm an example of love and joy. I see every day as joyous. And it's a lovely way to live, I can assure you. Okay, and this is what I want for everybody else. And although it sounds difficult, it's actually not. And it's January now. At the beginning of January, I saw lots of things about making plans for the year and actually setting goals and things like that. And if you think about that, any goal that you set now for the future must be something that you'd like now. Right? Because sometimes we set goals for the future and then we go off the idea before we get there. But at the time, you must have wanted it. So if we put off to the future joy and happiness and love, we're actually saying, well, I haven't got it now, and I'm not bothered if I don't have it now. I'll accept it when. And there's always a when and an if and a but. So when I've got more money, I'll be happy. When I'm in a different relationship, I'll be happy. When this happens, I'll be happy. And the choice really is, well, why not now? Why not now? And we go, oh, well, the circumstances at the moment, you know, this is going on and that's going on and that's going on. So I'm in turmoil, and we've always got what I call challenges, and other people call problems. They happen every day, and if you go out to work every day, you meet new challenges. And we don't particularly call them problems at work; it's just something we know we have to deal with. And some things are harder to deal with than others. But it's all about how we believe things are. So what I'm going to do in quite a short time is explain how your mind works. So even you youngsters can appreciate this, and you'll be ahead of everybody at school because of this. Right? So I need to hang on every word I say. Okay. When we're born with certain programs. We know how to eat, drink, poo. We know how to breathe. Our blood knows how to circulate. Everything that we need to survive is there. And we're also given the gift of our parents, who are there to help and nurture us for as long as it takes until we can set up on our own. And with humans, that's a lot longer than it is with animals. Animals are kicked out of the nest in a few months or whatever. Or something's reared, and as soon as it can walk and everything else, it's on its own. But humans are raised. And during the first years of a life, we start to add to the things that the brain knows. So the brain's kept you alive so far, and it knows everything it needs to, and it's designed to help you go towards pleasure and move away from pain. That's its whole emphasis on life, is to keep you alive and to keep you in pleasure where it can and avoid pain. This is why foods and other things are pleasurable, so that we actually look for them to find them. If food was horrible, we wouldn't live very long, would we? Because we'd go, oh, I'm not going to eat that stuff. Oh, crikey, that food is horrible. Right? So we would all die. So we are designed to be this thing that seeks our pleasure. And we're all born with love and joy. We all start off with the same amount of it. And somewhere along the way, we lose that. We get told when we're playing that our imaginary friend is not real anymore. And we don't understand that. It's real to us. And everything we think and believe is real to us. So if somebody tells me something when they're in my therapy, however outrageous it may seem, you know, I've been kidnapped by aliens or something, I accept it as true. Because it's true to them, and that's what's messing them up. As soon as I can get them to see the reality of the situation changes. And I do a lot of work with people who have anxiety all their life. And this always starts as a one-off instance. Nobody ever tells you that. If you're anxious, there is one instance in your life where something happened that either made you so angry or frightened or upset. Something happened where the chemicals took over your body, and in that moment you're sort of locked rigid and you don't know what to do, and it's horrifying, particularly for a small child, because you can't rationalise it. You can't say, oh, that's called fear. Oh, I've never felt fear before. Well, that's what it feels like. You can't do that. You actually just think this alien's took over you or something, and it's like, oh, I don't know what to do now. And in that moment of panic, or whatever you would like to call it, the unconscious mind, which is programmed to look after you, says, oh, that's horrendous. I don't want you to ever feel that way again. And so it makes up a little program. But it makes up a program at the same time as you're full of this horrendous chemical. Now, this is a bit like getting drunk and then having a tattoo. Right? It's a silly idea, but you're drunk at the time. Okay? But you've got it for life. And the same happens with anxiety. Something happens, the brain goes, oh, I never want you to feel this way again. So it makes you anxious. And anxious is just being hyper-vigilant about something, something that you don't know about, terrible is about to happen. And so anxiety to me is this sort of, what it is, I can feel something bad's going to happen. And you feel like that all your life. And the idea is, if it makes you hypervigilant enough, next time somebody wants to cuff you around the back of the head, you'll see it and you'll duck. That's what the unconscious thinks it's doing for you. It thinks it's protecting you. But what it's done now is it's made like a safety blanket. So you have this safety blanket of anxiety, of constantly thinking some bad about. Well, whatever we look for is what we find. It used to be an old riddle that was like, what do you look for but hope not to find? And it was holes in socks. And whatever we look for, we find. And the way our brain works is it tries to understand the world. So if we feel a certain way, we don't want to think, oh, we're being stupid. Or this isn't appropriate, we actually think, well, there must be a reason for this. So we then look for the reason. But when people are anxious, it's a lack of self-worth. So if you set off from quite an early age with a lack of self-worth, you keep that going. Because everything you look for, you look to everybody who talks to you or says anything, you're listening to them and looking for the lack of self-worth that's coming across. You're listening to hear all the criticism they're going to give you. You're not listening for the good stuff. And if you've got somebody that's always dragging you down, and you went to see them one day, and they'd had a bit of an epiphany, and they thought, I'm going to be nice to everybody from now on, this person would say, you're looking lovely today. And you would go, why are they saying that? It must be a trick. Right? So you get so locked into this anxiety that everything you see convinces you the lack of self-worth. The most extreme example I can give is somebody who's taken into care at an early age, and somebody comes along to adopt them. And so the child goes to the adopted family, and they say to the child, we love you, Mr. Johnny, we love you. And he goes, you can't do, you've only known me a week. And they go, no, we love you. We chose you, you're special. So he then does everything he can to be naughty, to test them out. Because then he can say, "Hey, you don't love me now, do you? Right? I just smashed that plate on the floor. Do you love me now?" "Yes, we still love you." And then he does more and more dangerous things because he wants to fit in with how he sees the world, which is nobody could love me because I'm horrible. And he will do more and more dangerous things until one day he sets the house on fire. And they all get thrown outside. And he goes, "Do you love me now?" And they go, "Yes, we do love you, but we've got to send you back to the home because we'd like to sleep at night." And then he goes back to the home and smiles because he's now proved it's true that nobody loves him and he can't be loved. How many of you are doing that? It's virtually, I was going to say it's 99.9% of everybody I see has this lack of self-worth. It's actually not. It's 100%. I have not yet had anybody come to see me who has any degree of self-worth. It just messes it up so much because we keep looking for the rejection. And the same happens in relationships. If when we're younger we have somebody who is awkward to please, what we do is we have to, everything, sorry, let me go back to the learning cycle. So everything we learn all the things to keep us alive before we're born, and then we start learning things from everybody around us. And this happens up until about the age of 6. We just copy everybody else. So we see other people walking, we see them talking, and we want to do it. And so at first we talk gibberish, and eventually the mother will listen in and understand what they're saying. And their siblings actually will tell you what they're saying, even when you can't understand what they're saying. So they do get to this point where they can express themselves just by copying other people. And we keep improving that skill over the years. So everything we learn, we repeat over and over and over and over again. We get better at it each time. And when we first start with a skill, we're terrible at it. Right? Because we've never seen it before. We don't know how it works. We have to watch, observe, listen. We have to do the whole lot. And then we start to copy. So for instance, walking. With walking, we see other people upon two legs, but we set off crawling because that's all we can do, and then we'll shuffle, and then we'll even do the bottom shuffle and things like that. And then eventually we'll get to the point where we stand up by holding onto something, and then we can let go, we keep falling over, and we keep repeating it until we can walk. And at no point, and I've never heard any mother on the planet ever say this, does your mother say, "This walking's not for you, I would give up"? So we persevere with it, and we just keep on and on, despite the fact we fall over. Thank goodness for nappies. Right? We'd all have bruised bottoms, wouldn't we? So we carry on doing things until we can do them. And this is a process of learning by repetition. And most of the things we do in life, we learn by repetition. We keep doing it and doing it and doing it. So when we first do something, we're consciously doing it. And we're aware of everything about it. And if we're young, we haven't done anything like it before, so it's even worse. When we get older and we do something new, we can say, "What have I done similar to this?" and get some benefit from what you've already learned. Right? So, and we just adapt it. And like today, we have to do this thing of seeing everything in a similar light. So you all came in and sat on a chair. Now, you've never seen that chair before, but you knew how to sit on it. You knew it was called a chair, and you knew you could move it, and you knew you could sit on it, and you knew how far back to sit on it to get comfortable. If you have to learn that every day, you have a problem. So what we're forming every time we learn something is like a little loop that goes round, and whenever you need it, this loop starts up and goes, "Oh, this is what's happening, I've seen a chair. Okay, this is what I do now, I sit on it." Okay? And you can choose when to sit on it and everything else, but you know how to do it, because that loop runs. Sometimes these loops are not the right loops. So up to the age of 6, we observe everybody around us and we see everything, how it goes on. We also observe relationships. So if mum and dad get on great, that's what we expect when we get older. We expect a great relationship. If mum and dad are always falling out, or hit each other, or whatever, we see that, and we see that as normal. Because we have no other way of seeing it. If you think think about, like, the princes, they grew up in the royal household. They wouldn't know that we live in little boxes. Right? In fact, every time they go out anywhere, everything smells of fresh paint. That's their life. That's all they know. So you can't ask somebody about their life, how would it have been if it had been different? Because you don't know. So you live in your own circumstances. Up to the age of about six, you're just copying everything as though that's the lesson to learn. After six, you get a bit more discriminatory. It's not a fixed age. I mean, you can do it earlier and things, and I think kids do it earlier now, is that they challenge things. And so this is the one you get to the stage of going, why? Why, Mummy? Why? You go, it is, it just is. Now, why? And they want to know why. And actually, although it can be incredibly annoying, I've got two kids and five grandkids, it can be incredibly annoying, but it's a brilliant sign that they are now discriminating what they're taking on board, they're learning the rules and regulations of how that thing works. This applies to absolutely everything, from combing your hair, brushing your teeth, the whole lot. You know. It all works on the same principle. There's a little loop that goes, this is how I do it. If you learn it badly at that age, you'll probably carry on doing it badly for the rest of your life. But it can all change. After the age of six, you're doing all these things, and we also update skills. So like walking, if you have a leg injury all of a sudden, you will still be able to walk, but you'll walk with a bit of a limp now. Because you'll adapt all the things you need, you don't fall over, you just walk differently. If you learn a new language, you actually expand, and your English gets better as well. Just from learning a new language, because you understand the other language, and the adaptation of that is how your brain works. So your brain works in a certain way. There are, if you come to my stand downstairs, there's a little plasma ball that you can touch. You touched it earlier. And when you see it working, it's just like this, these plasma shoots off. And they're very fine lines. And that's your brain when it makes new connections. So when you learn something new, off it goes and it makes this new connection and it goes, right, that's how it works. If you don't repeat it again in 2 or 3 days, it just goes, I don't know if we need that anymore. And it will just sort of start to wither away and lose that connection. If you start to use it on a regular basis, it strengthens that connection. So if you go downstairs and touch that plasma ball, you'll see this really fine line. But when you touch it, it thickens up, and it's really strong, and everything else around it seems to be drawn into that energy of it. And this is what happens when we learn something over and over again. It turns from being a neural pathway into what I call a neural motorway. So you've now got this thicker filament with a stronger connection. And so whenever you think of anything, oh, how do I do this, or what do I do now, or should I be happy now, it'll look for the connection. And if it's a really strong connection, it will find it straight away and zoom down it and make everything work. Now, everything we think of alters our body chemistry. Okay? And it alters how all our muscles work inside and everything. Our thoughts are the biggest factor in our life. I'm just going to get you to do a little experiment here. So, I want you to sit up, nice and alert. And what I'd like you to do is think of something nice, something really happy. Okay? When you've got that nice and happy, what I want you to do is I want you to fold in a bit, and so bring your shoulders in and put your head down a bit and try and hold on to that happy feeling. Make something happy. And then curl into that ball there. Now, I want you to stay in that place, because now you can't think of that happy thing so much. It's not as happy, is it? So I want you to think of something sad while you're there. Not too sad. I've only got a box of tissues. So think of something sad now. And as you think of that thing sad, just go back to your original position and put your shoulders back and your head up in the air and try and continue to think of that sad thing. Very difficult, isn't it? Okay. So this is why exercise is brilliant for depression. Because if you have thoughts and feelings, you're changing all your body chemistry straight away. And as you change your body chemistry, you also change your internal. And I think of it as extreme as this, is that is joy. And if you see that anybody doing that on the street, big smile on the face, you'd go, oh, joy, you just recognise it straight away. The strange thing is, even people who are blind at birth, if they get in joyful circumstances, they'll still do that. They've never seen anybody else do it. It's the same as all smiles are the same way. If you see somebody looking miserable and they say, well, I'm smiling, well, you've got a rare one. Okay? So your body takes on the feelings that you have. So if you're in a constant state of anxiety, you're actually, I mean, you don't see people going down the road going like this and you go, oh, they're depressed. Well, they would be because they'd walk under a bus, wouldn't they? But that's what's happening inside them. And if you notice that, like sadness is like this, but as soon as you get to depression, it's also this. It's like, and you can keep out. Right? So we don't want other people in. But that's, it's sort of a mixture of the two things. Our thoughts trigger it off, which then trigger off all these tension inside your body, which then keeps you in that. So how you can escape it is to literally change your body shape. When anybody comes to me with a problem, I'll say, right, just go into that problem for a moment. Just take yourself to the last time you had that problem. And you'll see them start to change in the chair, and they'll go down, and things will start to move. And then they'll go, yeah, I'm there now. And you can tell them there. And I'll go, I'll just move along. And they'll snap out of it. It's like, well, carry on with that thought. And they go, well, I can't. Just simply by moving one part of the body, they can't carry on with that thought process. Because the two things are linked. The way you feel and the way you think are linked together. And it's a bit chicken and egg, but to me it's the thought comes first. So there's two sorts of thought. There's one is the conscious thought. So the voice in your head, have you got a voice in your head? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We all have. So sometimes people don't know that and they think they're going crazy because you've got a voice in their head. But we've all got a voice in our head. That is your conscious. Because you're aware of it. And I don't call the unconscious the subconscious because it's not below anything. It's way, way above your conscious. Your conscious holds 8 bits of data. If I were to tell you my phone number now, 1 digit at a time, and then carry on talking, if I asked you to remember my number, you'd either be able to hold on to the number and not listen to me talking, or you'd listen to me talking but forget the number. You couldn't do both. That's how little the bit we think we're clever with works. It doesn't work much at all. There's only one purpose of having a conscious mind, and that is that we direct what we want to do. And we all use it terribly. We all direct it to what we don't want to do. We think about what's going to happen that's horrible in the future. And going by this chemistry thing, you also need to know that the unconscious mind works 100 times faster than your conscious mind. So when you get this sudden feeling of something, you've obviously observed or triggered something off that says, oh, now's the time to be frightened or angry or scared or whatever. And it's been noticed at the unconscious level, 100 times faster than your conscious will find it. So we go into that feeling and we go, oh, I've got to get out of it, I've got to get panicky, before you actually go, why? What's happened? And you might not even be aware of it then. It might totally be an unconscious thing. So you have two ways the brain works. The bit you're conscious, aware of, and the bit you're unaware of it. And that's why I call it the unconscious. Not unconscious as in, but you're just not aware of that thing that's happening. And it would help if I turn this microphone on and show it records. Luckily, I've got another recorder. Okay, so you've got two ways in which it works. But because the unconscious happens faster, and because it has access to every single program of everything you've ever learned, as soon as it sees something, it tells you how to behave. It alters your chemistry in a flash. And in fact, you did it a few seconds ago when you went from happy up here to sad down there, back up to happy again. You actually changed the chemistry in that split second between the two things. Now, when we have thoughts, if we think about the past, I'll start again with this. There's three parts to time. There's the now. That's the only bit we ever have. Because when we go into the future, that'll be the now. We can't go back into the past. We just can't. We can revisit it in our thoughts. The same way that we can visit the future in our thoughts, we can't actually travel there itself. So we always live in this bit called now. And this now keeps moving. It just another day, another day, another day, and keep going. So for the whole span of your life, you know how long this bit has been, you don't know how long this bit will be. If we plan to be happy over there, like somebody who came to me a few weeks ago, her and her husband have worked really hard all their life, planned for this fantastic retirement, going to have a camper van, go to Europe and travel all over the place. Got a year before retirement, husband had a stroke. A year later had a heart attack. Within 6 months, double incontinent. Totally deaf. Sits at home all day. This woman is now, I've given up all this bit of life to get to here, so I could really enjoy myself in this bit. And she's got to here and it's all changed. So now she's not only fed up because she feels that she worked so hard to get to this, but she's also like, well, I should be having this now. She's also guilty that her partner is like, she has to help and care for him. She'd be guilty if she left him or did anything else so she could do these things herself. So she's now trapped in this terrible world of, if only. You only have this moment once. That's all you get. I used to hate ticking clocks when I was a kid. I realise why now. Because every time it clicks, that's another second you're knocking back again. I'm going to get into the joyous bit now. The past is over and done. Right? To get to here, to get to be sat here today, everything you've ever done has led you to being here today. And if this changes how you think, it's a very good thing that it led to you being here today. So you come along and you carry all your learning from the past to here. Now, I want you to think about whether you, how much of that you want to carry along further on with you. And I'm going to give you the example of, if I was to say now, I'm going to treat you all to a fantastic holiday, and I said, but you have to take every suitcase you've ever took with all the clothes that you ever took on holiday before. You'd think I was stupid. You have clothes that didn't fit you anymore, were too small, too big, out of fashion, didn't like them, too hot, too cold for the climate, whatever. And yet, this is what we do. We've never had a declutter in our heads to get to this point to go fresh start. Because today is a fresh start. Just for a few moments, I want you to close your eyes, please, for me. Just get as relaxed as you can. And I'm going to take you off to an art gallery. It's a big, impressive building. And I'm going to go in with you so you're nice and safe. And I'll lead you wherever you need to go. And as I take you into that art gallery, I want you to see the longest gallery you've ever seen. A really long room. And one wall of it has a canvas. And as I reveal the sign to you, it is actually a canvas about you. It's the canvas of your life. And about halfway mark, there's a thin black line with tape over it. And if you peel that off, that will show you today when today's over and done. So that's covered up for now. But the left-hand side of the canvas is everything that's ever happened to you in your life that you can remember. The good times, the bad times. Not the indifferent times. It won't remind you what you had for breakfast 22 years ago today, unless you've had the same breakfast every day for 22 years. But there'll be pictures there that actually match things that you remember. Good stuff, bad stuff, but not the average. None of that's there. And as you stand back from this picture, you can see the overall colour of this picture, like a big collage of colours. And on the right-hand side of the canvas is a huge blank white canvas, absolutely untouched. And you have the skills to paint that right-hand side of the canvas with whatever you want to paint on it. Now, this is where you get the choice. When you've finished painting that canvas, you can actually frame it in any way you want. You can frame the whole canvas of all your life, or you can move that frame up to this black line and actually start afresh with that fresh, clean white canvas. And so the choice is yours. Would you like to have new or clean brushes? Wash those brushes out. Have paints, all fresh paints that you can paint on this new canvas. And the choice is yours. You can actually do that now. Because you have every skill that you've ever learned has been brought with you until now. And you can choose now to leave the baggage behind and stop painting the same picture on the right-hand side. Or if you're very content with your life, you can carry on painting exactly the same picture. But don't paint the same picture on the right-hand side if you don't like what's on the left-hand side. Why would you want to carry on painting in the same way that you don't like? Just because that's all you think you have at the moment. You have that choice now to paint that right-hand side. And you can colour it in first. If I were to colour in my canvas, I would have a beautiful golden yellow representing the sunshine. Or you can think of something you want in your life and the colour that represents for you. And paint that background because that's your intention for the future. And I'm going to take this a little bit deeper now. As you walk away from that with the lessons that you've learned so far, I'm going to take you now to a small private room. And this also is a room dedicated to you. Whatever is holding you back from starting that new canvas, whatever is that problem, is a picture on the wall covered up now with a drape. And I'm going to take that drape off now and you can look at that canvas. Your unconscious mind will show you exactly what the problem is that's holding you back. As I pull it down and you can see the canvas now clearly, just look at that picture and absorb the information that you get from that. You might not in this very second understand what that picture is, but whatever you see there is not just a random picture. Your unconscious is showing you now what holds you back. And it's a bit like dream analysis. You might need to sort of ask other people or whatever to check it out. People who know you well will be able to tell you roughly that, yes, that's you anyway. Okay? So I want you to take and absorb everything you can from that picture because we're going to move away in a second. Let's just sip a little more. As I put the drape back over that picture, I'd like to move now into the next gallery. Yet again, it's another private gallery. And in a small room is a nice, the same size canvas as the previous one, draped over. And as we approach it, I'm going to uncover this in a moment. This is also dedicated to you. And this time the picture is what the real problem is. Previous one was just the symptoms. And as you look at this picture now that shows you the real problem that's holding you back, start to look at that picture and see and absorb everything that's on that picture. Taking every detail, taking everything you need to understand about that picture. And as soon as you're there, we're going to move on to the next room. We go to the third room. And as we get there, there's now a very large canvas. And I'm going to whip the cloth off in a moment, and it's beautifully and detailedly made. That is such a word. And as I whip the cloth off the canvas, you can now see the solution to your problem. Whatever that picture may be. I want you to look at every single inch of that canvas. Look for all the clues. Look for all the things happening on it. Be very aware of everything that's there on that canvas. You might not fully understand this, but this is a message from your unconscious. It's giving you all the solution there. And because it comes from your unconscious, that means your unconscious holds all those clues. I'm going to cover that picture up now, and we're going to exit the gallery, but we're going to go through the shop. And in the shop, I just purchased for you an identical copy of that picture. I'm rolling it up now, and you're going to tuck it under your arm, and you have that picture of that solution whenever you need it. And you can go back here at any point and look at this. You can unfurl that solution and see what it is you need to do. Your unconscious will keep looking after you in that way. Okay, so as you have your roll of this wonderful picture, I'd like you to all thank your unconscious for working with you today. Because your unconscious works every minute of the day keeping you safe, and we never ever thank it. Can you imagine doing great stuff all your life and nobody ever thanks you? I want you to thank your unconscious profusely for everything it does for you, from your heartbeat to everything else. As you come back into the room now, to count to five. One's feeling better now. Too good to be true. Three, from all that old rubbish. Four, she's a jolly good fellow. Five, come alive. Back into the room. Okay. Did everybody see something? Did you learn anything new about yourself? It's amazing when people, particularly like, have dreams and things, and repetitive dreams. Even before I became a therapist, I used to do weight loss consultants. And a woman came to see me one day, and we were quite friendly, and she said, oh, I keep having this dream, and she told me all about her life. And she said, I had this dream, I'm on this roller coaster, it's going up, and it's down, and it goes through this big water at the end, and it all covers me and drapes me and all this. And it was exactly the story of her life that she told me. And she just couldn't understand this dream, why she kept having this dream. And I went, but that's your life. And she went, oh, it isn't it? If we have anything, bodily illnesses, bodily ailments, aches and pains and all sorts of things, if you haven't been particularly doing something that can bring that on, it's a message from your unconscious to you to say stop it, or don't hold yourself like that, or stop doing that. And we all hold tension in different parts of the body. My partner has problems with the shoulders, but that's because she does the sort of like, oh, you know, things are a bit tough at the moment, and does that. And that puts all this tension in one place in the shoulders. And a good problem for the shoulders is to do that, lift your shoulders up. Anybody having a problem with the shoulders? Right. If you just do that, and put your shoulders back and drop them again, your shoulders actually go where they're supposed to go. I was told this about 3 years ago in the Qigong class. And the guy kept correcting me because my shoulders were always like that. And I kept doing that. The young woman came to see me a few months ago who had had anxiety all her life. She was 40 and she had it since she was 9. And I cleared 31 years of anxiety in about 3 hours with her. And but she held the tension in the shoulders. And I said, so one final thing is, I just want you to correct your shoulders. What I want you to do is lift your shoulders up and then take them back and drop them down. About 2 weeks later on Facebook, I wrote this wonderful testimonial for me, and it said, Stephen's cured me, I had all these horrible things put around the house, I had to have somebody nearby, everything since I was 9, it's all gone now, I feel great. And by the way, I got a 5 grand boob job for nothing. So, about love and joy. What I said earlier on about the way we perceive things is our reality. So if you're a very positive person, it's because you see things positive, and so you're always looking for the positive, so that seems to be what happens to you. If you're always looking for the poor me, something's happened again, that's what you'll find all the time. We've all got friends, and every time you go around there's a major drama and something's happened, and oh, poor me, and everything else. But when you actually listen to it, it's no different to what you cope with all week. Right? It's just that they're making this massive drama out of it. But the reality is, they're not able to stop that because the drama is in the head, and because they exaggerate things, they actually multiply how bad it is, but then they act as though the reality is the multiplication of it. A woman came to see me a few weeks ago. She'd been on holiday, she's a single mum, been on holiday with her son for 4 days in Cornwall, hired a cottage, and then said, I said, oh, how do you get on? She said, oh, it was horrible. It ruined the holiday. There were 100,000 things wrong with the cottage. So I went, 100,000 things? Yes! So I said, name them. And she went, well, yes. There were thousands of things wrong with it. I went, well, just name two or three for me. Well, it wasn't very clean. And then she struggled to find more than it wasn't very clean. So I said, so how did it ruin the holiday? She said, well, I spent every minute of the holiday on the phone to all the travel reps. I was trying to get through to the manager of the company that owned this thing. So eventually I did, and I've told him off, and I've done this, and I've done that, and I've done the other. And she carried on like this. So I said, so who ruined the holiday? She said, he did. I said, but you didn't get in touch with him while you were there. So it can't be him that ruined the holiday. He didn't even know about it. Oh, well, it was the travel rep. I said, so, well, no, it wasn't the travel rep that ruined the holiday. So who ruined the holiday? And I had to go on for about 5 minutes until she went, well, I did. Because she'd gone there to have a good time. And however many things were wrong with it, you know, move into a hotel sooner when you get back. You know, or put up with it for 4 days and have a row when you get back. But to actually ruin your holiday while you're there, in it, because you have to think about the purpose of why you're doing something before you go off on a tangent of how terrible it is and nobody does things right. And the more we do things right, the more we think everybody else should be doing things right and perfect. And when I go and listen to speaker like me, I get very critical because I go, well, I wouldn't have done that. Because I know how it should be done. So when we know how things should be done, we can be very critical of how other people do it. And the thing about tolerance is that not everybody's the same as us. Every single person on this planet is absolutely unique. The great thing is, for me, is that your brains all work the same way. They have a set pattern of how they work. The content is totally different. But how your brain works and how it puts things together, I can actually observe from what you say and what you do. It becomes very easy to me now to actually see what's going wrong and what programs are going wrong. You only need one program in your life in the background that affects you. And I can bet your life it was probably when you were about 6. And it sets off, and it keeps you in that mode of, I can't be happy because something's about to happen, something bad's about to happen. And because you're in that something bad's about to happen, you keep looking for it, and then you keep finding things that are not that thing. that's not the thing that you're worried about. The thing that you were worried about has long gone. 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, gone. It's never going to happen again. You're carrying around a program you no longer need. That's what I specialise in, removing those programs. So, love and joy. We're born with it. We have it knocked it out of us in some way, shape or form. People tell us everything about us. They tell us we're ugly, we're fat, we're clever, we're too pretty, we're too nice. There's a whole range there. Average is fine. Nobody picks on you if you're average. But if you're one way or the other, too fat, too thin, you get picked on, too clever, too not very clever, you get picked on. It's everybody will knock somebody down because they're not like them. And I'm afraid it's something we just have to go with the flow because we're not going to stop it. It's not like ordinary bullying, it's sort of, it just happens. People just don't like, people aren't like that. But nobody's like you. You are a unique blend of all your experiences. If I had two twins here who were born, identical twins, born exactly at the same time, they would have different personalities, they'd have different life experiences. Even if they'd been in the same class at school, if the teacher had said something that badly affected one of them, it wouldn't affect the other. Because we see what we expect to see. We only look for that. I had a love message on my wallet that I didn't see for a week. Because when I first looked, the first time I saw it, I was distressed because my car had just been burgled. That love note disappeared for a week, was in plain sight in my wallet every time I opened it up. And until one day my thumb touched it, and I went, what could my thumb have touched? And this post note became visible. I'd had it for a week. My partner was outside of me. And I went, oh, thank you for that. When did you put that in? She said, last Monday. Luckily, I wasn't in trouble. But it was like, it just shows you what the brain thinks it's going to see is what you see. It's like when we frighten ourselves, we see a dark shadow and we presume it's a bogeyman or something. It never is. It's just we turn it into that. And as we get more and more fearful, it becomes more and more the problematic thing that we thought it might be. Now, the great thing about love and joy is, and I only twigged onto this a couple of years ago at most, if you've heard the Bible story, the barley loaves and the fishes, I didn't quite understand that, how you end up with more than you start with. But if you accept it for what it is, a parable, and a parable is to teach you a lesson. And the only thing in life, you can't do it with loaves and fishes unless you're very talented. But you can do it with love. If you give love away, you actually get more in return. You now have all this love. So you give it away, and you get more in return, and then you give it away, and you give it away, and you give it away, and you keep getting more in return. It just happens like that. And the same with joy. When you go out, even if you just smile when you walk down the street, other people start smiling. And if other people start smiling, there's a knock-on effect, because people who see them smiling will smile. The same happens if you're miserable. We've all had a room that you go into and somebody walks in and it's like, they suck all the positivity out of the room when they walk in. It just goes. And they're best avoided, aren't they? And I've got a friend who does the opposite. I mean, she's mixed race and she's same height as Shirley Bassey sort of thing. And she bounds into a room like Shirley Bassey. I mean, she's the most lovely person. She's sort of, there's almost a, I'm here, love is. She doesn't actually do that, but it's as though she has done, you know, like she's announced herself coming in. And I was at an event like this a year or so ago. And she came in, and I just spotted her at the end of an aisle. And I'm looking, there's like five stands between me and her, at each side. And it took me like 15 minutes to get to me. And she hugged and kissed everybody off all the stands and things and got to me. And she's a medium, so I presume she knew them all. And when she got to me, she hugged and kissed me, and she said, oh, I can't believe it was a wonderful hug. She'll have to go and have a hug. And she waved to him, and she went, give him a hug. Anyway, yeah, later. And I went, you know a lot of people. She said, never met any of them before in the life. She just filled that room with joy just by going in it, just being herself, and just expanding this wonderful love. And it's quite an easy thing to do. And so I'm going to show you that, if you've all got time now, because there's not a next slot. So how are we doing for time? Fighting. Are you all right for 10 minutes? Just to do this wonderful exercise. Okay? So, love and joy to me are the same. Right? They're just really the same. If you've got a lot of love in your heart and you let it out, you can't help but get it back. And I'm not talking about this thing where people tell you you're too nice. That means you're actually doing things you shouldn't be. And you know you are, because you get fed up with doing them. That's the expression, too nice. It's not that you're too... But I don't think there's such a thing as too nice. I think there's just nice that's not appropriate for you anymore. Once you start to get to the point where people put on you and go, oh, you'll do that, but without even thinking about you. Most people, I think. If you're doing that, at some point you'll get resentful. And then everything you hear from that person, you'll just reject. And it'll just be, I really don't want to do this. I want to avoid them. I want to do all this. And the only way around that is to become more assertive, to actually start to say no now and again. Or if somebody says, will you do me a favour? I always start with, maybe. Great opening line. If you say yes, they then say, all right, Tuesday night I want you to do this, this and this. And then you end up saying, but I'm going out Tuesday night. Oh, you would say that. And then you feel guilty and you're on your back foot. Whereas if you say maybe, tell me what it is. You've now put the accent on that to say, oh, well, you really like to do this because, and they have to build it up into something you'd want to do. You've actually switched it round. And if somebody tells me something, and I'll quite often say, you know, I'd love to help you out, I can't be bothered. And I laugh. And this really blows their minds, because they now don't know whether I'm joking or they mean it. So they then have to... They either get too embarrassed to ask me anymore, so I'm out of it, or they'll have to ask me really, really nicely and tell me why it's really good for me. So I'm not talking about that sort of nice. But you can give out love and not be afraid, and it doesn't particularly come back from the same person you give it to. But if you're forever giving out love, it's a stock you can't deplete. You can't actually run out of love. Because if you run out of it, just give some more away. Keep giving it away, and it will come back time after time, and it will multiply. The same with joy. The only way you can stop getting love is when we have a heartbreak. So we have a heartbreak. What we do then is we weld it shut. There's no love coming out of this heart anymore because I got it broken once. You will live the rest of your life in heartbreak. Not a great place to be. Open your heart up again. Just be a bit more discriminatory about who you let in as a partner. But you can give love to anybody. You can give love to random strangers. It really doesn't matter. Just give love away at every opportunity you get. And the misery people, the people that are negative hoovers who come and suck all the positivity out of them, they need love more than anybody else. Because can you imagine how everybody reacts to them all the time? So they're really negative, so everybody they talk to goes, oh yeah, and they might go, oh yeah, I'll sympathise with you. That's the best they're going to get. Most people will start avoiding them. All sorts of things happen, and that then they go, yeah, nobody likes me, nobody loves me. And then they tell you that, and then people keep leaving them. And so they need love more than anybody else in the world. So, here's a little exercise for you. It's a nice one with your eyes closed. Just get as comfy as you can. What I'd like you to do is think of somebody or something, if you've got a pet or whatever, that you love absolutely and unconditionally. So just draw that image up of them or that group of people, your kids and grandkids or whatever you like. And just start to look inside you and feel where that feeling is inside. Notice any tension, any excitement, any fluttering, any relaxation. Just notice that feeling. And as soon as you've located that feeling, I want you to imagine it expanding, like start swirling it round. Swirl it round and round and round and allow the molecules to just get slightly further apart as it swirls round. And as it swirls round and gets bigger and bigger and bigger, it's starting to fill up every part of your body. And then it's getting really pressurized as it builds up and grows and grows and grows until it's bursting out under your skin, and it's really hard to contain it now. And as you feel it really hard to contain, I want you to let it out into this room. And I felt a wave of it there. Just feel it coming into this room. And as it comes into this room, I want you to spread it across the towel here. And then I want you to spread it out further and further and further until it occupies all the UK. And then it starts going overseas into all the different lands. And everybody it touches on the way joins in with this feeling of love. I just feel that love multiplying as it starts to head off. Now just visualize the world beneath your feet and just see it going in every direction, in every corner of the earth. And as it does so, it's touching everybody on the planet. 8 billion people are now being connected with you, with this love, and they're all increasing that love and making it flow further around. And now it's gone right around the world and it's coming back. And as it comes back into this room and back into you. And just feel that increase in love that you've sent out just now. And just understand that this is nothing I have done to you. This is something you can do any moment of your life, whenever you want to do this. I just want you to take that wonderful warm feeling and just absorb that for a few moments. Just while I tell you a wonderful story that I did this once at the BSSK fair a year and a bit ago. I was just sat there on my own, waiting for people to get into the room. And I did this and sat and looked around the world. And as it entered back into me, I just felt the most wonderful sensation. And as I looked up, this gorgeous woman approached me. And we fell in love, and she's been with me ever since. So it does work, Trudy. Trudy's not here today because she's got that cold. So, if you'd all like to come back into this room, how did you find that? Yeah, you can see from the smiles, not many people are saying much, but it's a wonderful thing, and you can do it yourself anytime. But just remember, just the very act, being loving or caring in any way, just increases what comes back to you. Don't look for it from that particular person. And in fact, what the thing that's been a very recent lesson to me is, we as people, and it's great to be in a partnership, it's absolutely wonderful. If you think you're 50% and the other person makes you hollow, that's when you struggle with life. You are 100% of everything you need. You might not think it. In fact, come and see me if you don't think that. I actually take, and this is mainly women, but I put them in front of mirrors and say, just say I love you in that mirror. Okay. If I was to go around now and hold a mirror in front of you, how many of you could say that to yourself? Anybody here? Not a one. Nearly one. And this is the issue. We have to start loving ourselves. Mothers are a special breed of people as well. Mothers care for everybody else but themselves. They start off caring for themselves, and then over the time, everybody else becomes more important than they are. And there's always this tendency to, well, when the kids are off now, I'll go back to this. Remember the tale I told you earlier about the woman waiting for retirement? We can't put anything off until later. We only have this moment now. Enjoy the time with your kids, but you also have to look after yourself in every way and shape. I read something the other day that said you can't pour from an empty vessel. And that really struck home to me. And as much work as I've done on myself, and as joyous as I am every minute of the day, and Barry's often seen me, I always smile, I always make the most of every day. Even when I have a tough day, I take the lessons from it and go, okay, what's today brought? Okay, it's over now, what can I carry forward to the future? But a few months ago I went to a monastery, the first time I ever done meditation. And the guy started off with this singing bowl, and he struck it, and there was like a wave went through me. Something resonated with me. And then he carried on talking, and then he said, right, I'm going to do this meditation then. And he struck this singing bowl, and I was on a chair, and I'm joking, I thought I was doing that. Right? But because I had my eyes closed and everything, and there's like 40 of us all sort of just sat there, and I'm sort of thinking I'm doing that. And then I got to the point where I thought, am I actually doing that, or is that just me in the inside? But there was such great movement, I thought, it can't be inside, it has to be an external thing. So I just moved my head a bit to see if that felt different to... And it did. But my body then went, oh, you want to do that? Yes. So next thing you know, I'm doing... I'm like this on this chair. Then, and because I do what I do, it didn't frighten me. I knew it was something about to be released. There's a thing called ab reactions that you can have now and then. I knew I was having an ab reaction, but I knew it was a good thing. So it didn't scare me, and it could have been terrifying. So suddenly I'm doing this, and I'm breathing badly and all sorts. There's a woman who does first aid sat next to me. She is meditating with one eye closed, one eye on me, because she thinks she's going to have to do first aid any minute now. And this carried on, and I was shaking. And I'm not joking, it's 15 minutes. I was shaking until I was physically exhausted. And I'd helped two or three people that week, and with each one, they were fine telling me they had a problem. As soon as I started working with them, I got poker face. They just didn't show any emotion, happy, sad, nothing. There was nothing on the faces, and I couldn't really work with them. So I got them all to look in mirrors, and so they were facing themselves. I was seeing them, and then when I just reeled off a list of things that might be the problem to watch the reaction. And because they weren't aware that I was watching them, suddenly I saw a reaction to what it was. So I knew what to work on. And then that became effective. But it was a real difficult one. But I had two or three instances of that week. So I thought, well, I'll ask my unconscious to tell me what it is. What is it I'd have to release? And it wouldn't. So I thought, right, I'll do that list. So I went through this list, and I thought, and I was getting through all the things I thought it might be, and I didn't get anywhere. And then I got to the thing that both of those broke down on, which was self-love. And I thought, well, I think I've got self-love, I'm fine. But I went, not self-love. And then the body went, oh my goodness me. With that, I don't know how this is divine approach or whatever, but this guy said, okay, we're going to mop up now. What I want you to do is lift your hands from your knees. I want you to put them on your chest, over your heart, and then you carry on with this thing. And I thought, ah, and he said, and that's self-love. That will take everything that we thought about and now make it self-love because it's all about planning and everything else. So I went, right, I'll do that then. That's what I need to do. And my hands are glued to my knees. I'm not joking. It was a full minute to get them off my knees, just above the knees. And then it was another full minute of fighting to get them on my heart. And as I put them on my heart, it actually went, well, if you want it that badly, I'll give you it. And I just collapsed sobbing. So there was all sorts of people sat around me, all worried about me. Luckily, nobody interfered, because that would have just stopped me in the middle of flight of this, and it would have been not very nice consequences, I think. But it was the most wonderful feeling then. So I realised that I need to do work on self-love. And if you become 100%, then you're bulletproof. Because if somebody comes into your life, and you've already got 100%, that's fantastic. You know, Trudy's coming to my life, there's another 50-100% there as well. So instead of me being 50%, Trudy's maybe 100%. If she ever left me, I'd be 50% again. I'm now 100%. Trudy's coming to my life, I'm 200%. Whippy, you know, the most brilliant thing in the world. If she ever left me or anything happened to her, I'm still 100%. I'll survive. So I want you to think about giving love and joy away. Becoming 100%, not seeing it as blowing your own trumpet or you love yourself too much or anything. You couldn't possibly love yourself too much. And in fact, you all know that you don't love yourself enough. So do whatever you need to take care of you. I don't mean spending money. That's a very shallow method of feeling good for a few minutes. Do things that make you feel good, that make you energetic. Exercise, eat nice stuff. And why do we eat stuff that's bad for us and call it a treat? You know, if you've got a petrol car and you put diesel in it for a treat, it won't thank you. Right. You know, start to call it what it is, chemical rubbish. Right. Shall I have some of that chemical rubbish I seem to really like? Or shall I have something that's good for me? I'll call it a treat. Shall I have a banana or an orange or a carrot or something like that? Okay. Start to really look after yourself. Open your heart, even if you've had it broken. That's the way to mend it. Let all that love out and don't care where it goes. It will come back and you'll have more than when you started. I've been Stephen Blake. You've been a fantastic audience. Thank you very much. If anybody does have any problems with anxieties or issues or has friends who have the same, please come see me on the store or take brochures and cards. Take as many as you like for your friends, because this, what the work I do literally does show people's lives.